this father took his son out fishing one day, and the son started asking those kinds of questions. He asked, "Dad, why is the sky blue?" The father thought, "Well," said, "I don't rightly know, son." "Dad, why is the water wet?" "Well, don't know that either, son." "Dad, why do fish live in the water and not on the ground?" "Well, don't know that either, son." A little bit, the boy said, "Dad, am I bothering you with all these questions?" Father said, "Of course not, son. If you don't ask questions, you can't learn anything." I think Mark does better than that. I'll tell a couple West Virginia jokes, and then we'll go on. Let's see. These are recycled Jeff Foxworthy jokes. And I'm from West Virginia, so I'm not allowed to tell them. You're not, if you're not from West Virginia. How can you tell if you're in a West Virginia church? The deacon in charge of the Lord's Supper calls on Bubba to help serve, and five guys and three ladies stand up. that's how you in a West Virginia church right there. Or one of the elders wants to be buried in his pickup truck because I ain't never been in a hole it couldn't get me out of. Now, I'm from there. I'm allowed to say those things. All right, let's turn to number 65, please. Number 65. Our theme this week has been "Use Me, Lord." We've not dealt specifically with the lyrics of the song, but we've looked at it from different aspects. Use me, Lord, however I can, whatever my circumstances were. Use me, Lord, when I am tired. My circumstances might change as I get older, but I can still be used in His service. And today's subject is, Lord, use me when I don't get my way. At least that's what I remember putting down. If it's something else, that's the one I'm going to address anyway. Use me, Lord, to teach the unlearned mind. Use me, Lord, to reach the fallen child. For I know it's not from me, but your vessel I can be. So, dear Lord, use me. Use me, Lord, to feed the ones in need. Use me, Lord, to mend the heart that bleeds. For I know it's not from me, but your vessel I can be. So, dear Lord, use me. Use me, Lord, to protect your holy name. Use me, Lord, to stop the sinner's gain. For I know it's not from me, but your vessel I can be. So, dear Lord, use me. Please turn, if you would, to the book of Ruth. As Mark has mentioned, book of Ruth, four chapters. It starts off like this. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. Now that gives us pause to remember what was happening in the time of the judges. The book of Judges is Ruth. I believe sometimes they might have been appended to each other when they circulated before we had the entire canon because they sort of... The book of Judges is a sad, sad time in Israel's sad, sad history because the people were in a cycle. Judges 2, 11 through 22, really explains that cycle. I won't take time to read it, but here's the cycle for you if you could picture a circle up here. First of all, the children of Israel would be right with God. Then they would sin. Then God would send an oppressing force, an army, a nation, to oppress them, put them into slavery, put them into bad situations for a while because of their sin. Then they would cry out to God, and He would hear them. He would send them a deliverer. He would send them a judge. We're not thinking of judge, of course, in the term of a black-robed fellow who sits on a bench and makes laws when he's supposed to be interpreting laws. Did I say that out loud? We're not thinking of that sort of judge. We're talking about a judge who did some of that, but was a military leader, a political, a sociological, a military leader in every way. God would send this person to deliver the people out of their bondage. And then they might be faithful during the time that that judge lived, and every once in a while, maybe a generation after, and then they'd sin again. And then God would oppress them again. And then they'd cry out again. God send them a deliverer again. And the cycle just kept going over and over and over. It's a lesson in us for how one generation is all it takes for apostasy to come on a good people. One generation. It happened over and over again in the book of Judges. Now, at this particular time in the book, time of the period of Judges, we don't know exactly when this took place. In my understanding of the book of Judges, chapters 1 through 16 kind of outline the whole history of it. And then chapters 17 through 21 kind of go back and fit in there somewhere with some particular stories about some atrocious things that took place because of the wickedness of the people. But then the book of Ruth kind of goes back in that time and tells us a beautiful story of goodness and righteousness and faithfulness, even in the midst of tragedy, that took place in a time of wickedness. And that reminds me that even in a time of wickedness, children of God shine as lights in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Philippians 2, 14 and 15. Just because most people are evil, just because most people lean towards ungodliness, paganism, whatever there might be, doesn't mean that we have to give up on love, truth, goodness, mercy. That's what we find in the book of Ruth. Now, it had its tragedy. It had its temptation. Naomi got a little bit off track for just a little bit, but it reminds us that some good can take place because of God's blessing, God's providence, and God's mercy. Now it came to pass, verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land. I don't know if that famine was part of the judgment from God. Later on, famines would be part of judgment from God. In the book of Ezekiel, chapter 14, verse 13, and many other places, God says, you know, when you disobey me, I'll send famine on you. In Deuteronomy 28, he said, when you disobey me, I'll make the skies as bronze above you. Rain doesn't get through bronze, and that was what he meant by that. So I don't know if that this famine was judgment or just happenstance. Doesn't really matter to the point of the story. There was famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, this sounds like a familiar place, doesn't it? Went to dwell in the country of Moab. Remember the Moabites? They were the children of Lot by one of his daughters. Remember how sin just keeps coming up in the Bible, but somehow, God uses it for good? Lot was vexed by the perversity of the people, I believe 2 Peter says. And when he finally escaped Sodom, his daughters got him drunk and lay with him and had two children by him. And that was horrible. It was awful. God didn't approve of that. But two nations came from that, the Moabites and the Ammonites. Well, here Moab comes along, a nation that should have never been because of that. If God's laws had been followed and they had respect for him, this nation would have never existed. But they come up and they save a family of Israelites during a time of famine. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting how God can work like that? So they go to Moab. A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Hi, how are you all? The name of the man was Elimelech. We're in Ruth chapter 1, if you have a chance to turn there. And if you don't, I sure understand. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem. I don't know if I'm pronouncing those right. I teach the guys at school, just make up a pronunciation and say it confidently. His two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. Why are they called Ephrathites? Well, back in Genesis chapter 35, the city of Bethlehem was also called Ephrath. In another passage of Scripture, it has the double name. Another passage of Scripture that's very important to our story. But you, Micah chapter 5, verse 2, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, even from everlasting. Who are we talking about? We're talking about Christ. His goings forth are from of old, even from everlasting, but he's going to come into the world in Bethlehem Ephrathah. So these are Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. I don't know if there's anything poetic there about that or not. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Moab had food and they didn't. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left and her two sons. We don't know how he died. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah. I understand that Oprah Winfrey was supposed to be named Orpah, but they misspelled it on the birth certificate. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Note a couple of things. One, the brevity of inspiration. How long would it take a novel writer to tell that story right there? 10 years passed. They go to Moab, and here's how God does it. They go to Moab, Elimelech dies, her two sons marry, they die, and they're done. The brevity of inspiration doesn't tell us anything we don't need to know. We might wonder how they died. We don't know if it was accidents. We don't know if it was disease. We just know it was tragedy. So now this woman is left, Naomi, having been run out of her home because of famine, with her husband, having her two sons happily marry in a land. She's probably thinking, we'll spend the rest of our lives here. We'll retire, have the children around. And her sons die, apparently and obviously, before they have any children. And she's left by herself, as far as blood relatives go, with two daughters-in-law. I suppose she's feeling about things right now. We'll find out later. Last time I taught this lesson, I talked about, you know, you don't want to lose your children before you. Some of you may have. I don't know. It's a tragic thing. What if you lost your husband and all your children? Come to find out later in that audience, there were two people who had lost their husbands and their two sons. Tragedy strikes. I don't get the things that I want. Things aren't working out the way I had planned. In some way or another. The Bible tells us these kinds of things in extremes. This is extreme. Verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. So the famine is over. It's been 10 long years. It's been a decade. Now the famine is over. So she says, well, you know, I might as well go back home. And she encourages her daughters-in-law to stay in Moab. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. They went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, now she's being kind here. She could have been like some people that I've known, said, these girls better come take care of me. These girls better do what I tell them to do. These girls better be nice to me. I was nice to them. No, she's very kind to them. She says, selflessly, go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. They had plenty to weep about. She's telling them, go back to your families. Maybe some other guy will come along in Moabite of a Moabite nation, and you'll be able to marry him and have a happy family. And I'll go back home to my household and see if there's anybody left there and see what's happening. They didn't travel in those days like we do. It's hard enough. A lot of you have traveled for the country, but you can hop on a plane and go see them. Well, they can't do that sort of thing. This was the time of the nuclear family like it was in the 1800s in the United States, where you grew up in the farmhouse and then you married and you built a farmhouse next to the farmhouse and you all worked the same land and your parents died and you had your kids and they stayed there. And I think there was less Prozac going around then. You know what I mean? I think people were happier then. But Naomi's not real happy right now. She just tells them selflessly, stay in Moab. I'm sure she'd like to have him with her. But she's being very selfless. I remember when Dad had bypass surgery in 1985. It was a very new thing in 1975 when he had his first one. He had his second one in 1985. They almost lost him. I was supposed to go on a chorus tour. I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay with him. And while he's hooked up to all those particular things in the IV room, hooked up to so many things for a long time, a much longer time than they have them hooked up to now, he looked at me and said, go on your trip. Go on your trip. You're being selfless. That's what Naomi's doing here. But the daughters-in-law said to her, verse 10, surely we will return with you to your people. But Naomi said, Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? You going to wait on me to have more kids? You going to wait on me to have another son? And if I did, you're going to have to wait 20 years for him to grow up so he can be an adult and marry you. Verse 12. Turn back, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And there you see a little bit of touch of the bitterness that will come up later. She blames it all on God. Do you know anybody that might lose someone or lose their way and they blame it on God? It's a temptation. And when I talk to people who blame it on God, I just listen. I don't shut them down. I just listen. Because it's a natural feeling that they have to work through themselves. Now, I might come to a point that I have to defend God and say, no, God didn't do this to you. But if they, I just don't understand why God would do this to me. I just don't understand. I don't understand either. Might be the best immediate response. And work on the theology of it later. Because you're not prepared for theology when you're emotionally distraught like that. I don't know why the Lord has stretched out his hand against me like this. You daughters-in-law stay here. And I'll go home. They argue once, you know. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to her. So Orpah gave the obligatory, well, I'll go with you. No, you go ahead. Well, okay, I'll go back, you know. But Ruth is serious about it. Orpah might have been too at first, but then Ruth gets really serious about it. And she said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And then you have some of the most beautiful words of love in the Bible. I've sung them at weddings for couples who are getting married. But these words weren't from a husband to a wife. They were from a daughter and mother-in-law. Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, Israel, shall be my people. And your God, my God. Every country had its own God at that time. Well, I'm going to go home. I'm going to make your God my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. What tremendous love. From a Moabite woman. Somebody who doesn't even know the God of heaven just yet the way that, well, she may have after 10 years living in Naomi's household. She may have known the God of heaven, the true God. She says, I'm going to be with you. Your God will be my God. When you die, I'll die with you. I'm going to be with you. Those are words of strong commitment. That's a commitment a husband and wife ought to have for each other. But notice that it's a commitment that friends ought to have for each other, that family ought to have for each other, that brothers and sisters in Christ ought to have for each other. These aren't limited to marriage, are they? They didn't even start out in the context of marriage. When she saw that she was determined to go, she stopped speaking to her. I don't think that means, well, if you're going to go with me, then fine. She stopped speaking to her. She just said, okay, you have it your way. She stopped telling her not to go. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they came to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? I haven't seen you in 10 years. The whole city gathers around. Hey, I don't know how they survived the famine. Maybe they went other places. Maybe they came back. But now the whole city's excited. Is this Naomi? And when she comes back, she said to them, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. And I imagine she said it something like that. Because Mara means bitter. Don't call me Naomi. You call me Mara. God has dealt bitterly with me. She is upset. She is angry. She is bitter. The word Mara means bitter. In Exodus 15, you remember the Israelites came to a place where the water was bitter, and they called that place Mara. And then there was a tree thrown in and the water was fine. That was one of the places they complained against the Lord. In Buddhist doctrine, Mara was some kind of demon that came and tried to tempt the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, first with very beautiful women and then with monsters. Mara was a bitter thing. It comes to mean bitterness in all the kinds of... I hope you don't know anybody named Mara. It doesn't mean the same thing now, I'm sure. But back then, Mara... very bitter. Don't call me. Now, is Naomi sinning here? It's again, I don't know. She turns out to be a great character, and if she's sinning here, it causes me no problem with my faith. I don't worship her, I worship God. Would you be tempted to be bitter at a circumstance like that? I would be tempted to be bitter at a circumstance like that. I've been tempted to be bitter at much less circumstances than that. Now, I was joking, as an illustration, I was joking with Liza this morning. The hotel you all put me up in has been wonderful, except the internet's been really slow, except for late at night. And so I think people were on it during the day or something. And I told her, she said, how's the place you're staying? I said, it's fine, except the internet's slow. I said, that's a first world problem. That's not a third world problem, you know. I don't have internet. Some people don't have water, so I can deal with that. You know, it's just not that big a deal. Mara was bitter. I've been tempted to be bitter over much lesser things than she was bitter over. That's why God told us, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, and clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. People will do things to you, even unintendedly. Sometimes in the church, people will do things to you unintendedly. Sometimes people in the church will do things to you, and you'll wonder if it was intended. Now, we have a method of working that out that we hardly ever use. What do you do if someone does something to you that you don't like? Well, you go tell the elders. That's what you do, and you gossip about it to everybody else. Is that what you do? No, you go to the person. But nobody seems to have the courage to do that. That works. And if they don't listen to you, then you take two or three witnesses. And that generally works. And if they don't listen, then you take it to the church, Matthew 18. But bitterness can just fester. The longer you let it sit there, the more the devil has you under his control. Don't call me Naomi. Call me bitter, because that's what I am. Verse 21. I went out full, she continues, and the Lord has brought me home again. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? She's blaming God for all of this. Does God make the evil things happen to us? Last I checked, no. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone, James 1:13. Now it is true that God tested Abraham, Genesis 22 verse 1 and Hebrews 11, 17, by faith Abraham when he was tested. Well, God can use certain people's evil to test us. There are people in the world that are evil, and they might do something to us, and that might be a trial for us, that if we come through, the genuineness of our faith then is much more precious than gold that perishes, because it has been tested by fire, 1 Peter 1, verse 7. God might use other people's wickedness to test us, but he doesn't make them do the wickedness. He's not the author of wickedness. He's not the author of sin. He's not the author of death. The devil is the author of death. She didn't know what we know about that, that the Lord would come and conquer him who had the power of death and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Hebrews 2, 14 and 15. I don't know if she had any hope beyond the grave for Mahlon, Chilion, and Elimelech or not. She's just bitter. Can you imagine that sort of bitterness? The Lord did this to me. Verse 22. So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabitess, and her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. All right, now chapter 2. Any questions, comments, or rude remarks on chapter 1? There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I might find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So we've got to understand something about the custom of the time, and that is gleaning. You'll remember probably from Leviticus 19, verse 9, Leviticus 23, verse 22, and Deuteronomy 24, verse 21, that the landowners of Israel were commanded not to take everything completely from their fields. They were not to glean it completely dry. They were supposed to leave some things there for the poor of the land to come through and get some sustenance for themselves. It was a sign of mercy. Yes, this field belongs to you. Yes, you get to keep the harvest from it. But don't you dare just strip it dry out of greed. You leave some of that for the people that come through that need it worse than you do. Leave it for the poor. So Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Now this man was of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. That's important for a couple of different reasons. Please look back at Deuteronomy chapter 25. I think you know I'm going there, but let's read it, please. Deuteronomy chapter 25, starting at verse 5. Part of the Levirate law, or the Levirate law as they called it. If brothers dwell together, and by that brothers, I don't think he means literal just that generation brothers, but kinsmen, like a cousin or something, your brethren, something like that. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside of the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Now that just seems like sickness to us, but that's the way it was then. It's not really sickness, it's not incest or anything, because they weren't really related. But here, a brother dies, his wife has no children, it's the duty of somebody else in the family to go into her and have children by her. Why? For tribal inheritance, for the rights, because God had the tribal inheritance in the land of Israel set up just the way he wanted it. He knew that there would be some things happen that kind of got in the way of that, so he made allowances for that. The brother is supposed to go into her and have children by her. Verse 6, and it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of the dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. Wouldn't be his child, it would be the dead brother's child as far as legal terms and inheritances were concerned. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then, that's a Freudian slip, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, because the gate is where legal proceedings happened. Remember, her husband is known in the gates of the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. The gate was where legal things happened. So if he doesn't want to do that, then let her brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders got to talk with him. The elders of his city shall call him and speak with him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then here's what happens. His brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, that was common for legal proceedings, spit in his face, indicating shame, and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. So if he's willing to endure that kind of shame, he can get out of his duty of raising up a son to his brother's house. Take his sandal, because this is a covenant that's been broken, spit in his face, and have the shame. And thus his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed. Well, you remember that the Sadducees tried to use this law against Jesus, didn't they? They gave him a hypothetical situation to try to disprove the resurrection. All right, Jesus, if there's a resurrection, let's say that a man has a wife and he dies and brother goes into her and he dies and brother goes in, and seven of them and none of them have any children. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection? And they think they got him stumped. But he says, no, you don't understand the scriptures or the power of God. In heaven, we don't marry or are given in marriage and we're like the angels of God. He deals with their argument. But that's the law behind that. Now, keep that in mind as we go back to the book of Ruth. That's important that they find someone, Boaz, who was of Elimelech's family, Elimelech being Naomi's first husband. That's important, and that will come up, as you know. Verse 4. Now, behold, Boaz... Oh, I didn't read verse 3, did I? Then she left and went in and gleaned the field after the reapers, and she, get this, happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. Happened to come, maybe providence there. She happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered him, the Lord bless you. I just find that a little bit sad and a little bit amusing at the same time. Wouldn't it be nice if we greeted each other that way? We say, what's up? The Lord bless you. The Lord bless you too. Well, we'd look really weird at each other at first, but that's how greeted each other because they had some respect for God. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? Didn't recognize her. She's not one of the usuals, maybe. So the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, it is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. She came to the master of the girls and said, let me be one of the gleaners. He said, okay, she's worked really hard. She rested a little in the house, but she's worked all morning till now. Verse 8, then Boaz said to Ruth, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close to my young women. Stay here. Don't think that you have to go after here for a while. Don't think you have to go somewhere else. You stay here and glean continually in my field and stay close to my young women. There's safety in numbers. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? Why would he have to command the young men not to touch her? Because men are pigs sometimes, you understand. And men have some desires that unrestrained get into some sort of forcible violence and things. He commanded them, don't you touch her. Don't you stay away from her. I don't know what they might think. She was a new woman. She was a Moabite woman. She was fair. I don't know what they might think, but he commanded them, don't you touch her. And when you are thirsty, he said to her, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. In other words, welcome to this family of gleaners in my household, so to speak. Verse 10, so she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? Foreigner. I'm from out of here, and you're still being so kind to me. I don't understand. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And Boaz answered and said to her, it has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since you left your father and the mother in the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before. You notice, you left your father and mother? Did you catch that? You left your father, you left your own whole household. Come take care of your mother-in-law. And your kindness has preceded you. It's been told about you. Now there's a lesson there for us. Proverbs 27 verse 2 says, do not boast about yourself with your own mouth. Let another man praise you with his lips. Something like that along those lines. Don't you tell it about yourself. You let other people talk about you. It'll come back around. That's what happened with her. I've heard of your kindness. That's why I want to be kind to you. Verse 12, the Lord repay your work and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Psalm 61 verse 4 speaks of the shelter of God's wings where we go for refuge. Well, you've come under his wings. And isn't that a great picture? Jesus used the picture when he was weeping over Jerusalem. How often I would have gathered you together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. Matthew 23, verse 37. Well, the Lord is protecting you, and I'm just his vessel. He's protecting you. You stay with the women. The men won't touch you. You get a drink here when you need to. You just be safe. Very nice of him. Then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. That doesn't sound like a real good meal to me, but it was some kind of wine. I've been to countries, particularly Italy, where they thrive on hard bread. They don't like the soft bread. They thrive on the hard bread that is just crunchy when you put it in your mouth. But then they dip it in something. I'm not sure what we dipped it in. They dip it in something to make it a little bit softer. And that's the custom that she had here. So he's telling her, come eat with me. You not only do you get to stay with the women, but you come and eat with me, the head of the household. Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers and he passed the parched grain to her and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. That's how the New King James reads. And kept some back. She was not a glutton. She did not just satisfy herself. She's satisfied, but she kept some back. Put that in mind for just a minute. And when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded the young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves. Let her have more than the regular gleaners do, and do not reproach her. Also let her grain from the bundles fall. Also let grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her. That is, when you're harvesting, would when she's behind you, and also let a little bit extra fall out of your basket so she can pick it up. When I started going to West Virginia Christian Youth Camp as a teenager, I was used to a society where everybody was very, very competitive in sports. I went to West Virginia Christian Youth Camp, and we were very, very competitive in sports. Bless our hearts, we didn't have video games, and we knew how to play ball. And we could play ball, and we could play ball very well. And we played hard, and we were competitive, but we were friendly about it. But we were teenagers, and we'd play against the staff, and it was a good, hard game going. And then one of the staff's kids would come up to bat. And he's standing about that tall. Every time, he'd get a home run, you know, because they'd just make him meet the ball, and then the pitcher would field it and throw it past the first baseman, and the first baseman would throw it past the third baseman, just to make sure he got around the bases and got all the way home. And that was just an unwritten rule for what we called staff brats, you know, little kid. Well, that's what he's doing here. He's saying, leave a little extra for her when she goes by. Leave a little extra and let her glean that to make sure that she has plenty. So she shows herself not gluttonous, and then she's going to have plenty. Verse 17, so she gleaned the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Then she took it up and went to the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied. What she had kept back was a plate for her mother-in-law. Isn't that sweet? She's just always thinking of somebody else. She's always thinking of her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law said to her, where have you gleaned today? And where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz. And Naomi probably lit up. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. And Naomi said to her, this man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives. Remember the Levirate law? What's Naomi got in mind now, huh? What's she thinking? Oh, maybe husband here. But notice the difference in her attitude. Earlier, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Lord God has dealt very bitterly with me. He has afflicted me. And now she says, blessed be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. She's got a better attitude now, doesn't she? She worked through it, and she's come to a better understanding of things. Don't be too harsh on people when they get bitter after a loved one passes in the family. They just need time to work through it. They just need time, a lot of cases. Ruth the Moabitess said, he also said to me, you shall stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women and that people do not meet you in any other field. I want to kind of keep you under wraps here. You know, when my daughter was 16, 17, I wanted to keep her at home all the time too. So I want to keep you here in this field. So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest and wheat harvest and dwelt with her mother-in-law. Chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? How am I going to seek security for you? In our day and age, talented women get a job, survive and thrive in the business world, and that's fine. The last I saw in Proverbs 31, she was a businesswoman. She considered a field and bought it, and you know, she was a virtuous woman. I realized Titus 2, 4, and 5 glorifies women in the role of homemakers. There's nothing wrong with that. Be a homemaker. Be proud of it. Be glorious in it. If you want to work outside the home, as long as it doesn't take away from your kids, you work that out with your husband. But don't work outside the home for greed. Don't leave your kids in daycare just because of greed. If you need the money, fine. But if you're going to do it just out of greed, rethink it. Well, you all know that already. And many of you have already been there and done that. And it worked it out. You know, my mom always worked outside the home. When she had me, she wanted to take 6 years off to raise me till I got to school. And she had to quit at 3 because Dad got that heart trouble and she had to go back to work. So I'm not faulting women who work outside the home at all. But she was able to balance and manage. Well, the point is here, how's Naomi going to seek security for her in that society? In that society, it meant husband and nothing less. In that society, security meant husband, family. It was patriarchal. It was man-oriented. Like it or not, that's the way it was. And she needed security. Now, Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So she gets some advice from Naomi. And the advice is this, starting in verse 3. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself. Probably been pretty dirty and sweaty out in the field all day. Put on your best garment and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. I am not of the opinion that some commentators are that there's anything immoral going on here. I think quite the opposite. It's very pure. If it were immoral, I guess we'd have to deal with it, but I don't think that there is. Just watch how it unfolds. I don't think his feet is a euphemism for something in the Bible. I don't think that here, though. Watch what happened. Uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And she said to her, all that you say to me I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. I don't think she's laying up beside him. She's laying probably crossways at his feet. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. See, not at his side, but at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." Well, she proposed to him, I guess, essentially there. Take your maidservant under your wing, your close relative. Levirate law, you got to know that. Then he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich." I don't know how old Boaz was, but he thanks her. There are younger men, there are better men, better looking men probably, whether poor or rich, and you could have had them, but you went after someone wisely. Now, you know, in our society, we marry for romance, we marry for love, but you want people to marry for some good reasons too. You want people to marry for responsibility, for financial security. And that's what she's trying to get her to do here. That's what he compliments her for. You didn't just go after somebody because they were cute. You went after somebody responsible. Can anyone send this recording to my daughter, please? Something like that. You went after somebody responsible, you see. And that, for that he commended her. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman." She's a virtuous woman. "Now it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I." Boaz is going to show his honor here. "There's somebody else that's first in line for you. Not me. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives." Takes an oath. "Lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet till morning. He's pure, she's pure. "And she arose before one could recognize another," apparently so there wouldn't be talk. "Then he said, 'Do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor.' Also he said, 'Bring the shawl that is on you and hold it.' And when she held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her. Then she went into the city. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, 'Is that you, my daughter?' Then she told her all that the man had done for her." Here's what he did. Here's what he said. "And she said, 'These 6 ephahs of barley he gave me, for he said to me, "Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law." He's going to take care of, here's a man who's responsible enough. He's going to take care of his new wife. He's going to take care of his mother-in-law, too. When you marry somebody, I try to tell young people, you marry their whole family, whether you like it or not. You marry their whole family. And he knows that, and he's shown it with a great gesture. "Then she said, 'Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day.'" He's a good businessman. He's going to go get this thing done. Chapter 4. "So now Boaz went up to the gate, sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, 'Come aside, friend, sit down here.' So he came aside and sat down at the gate of the city where things take place. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit down here.' So they sat down. Then he said to the close relative, 'Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, "Buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of Israel. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know it. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you.'" And he said, "I will redeem it." He tells him about the land that belongs to her that he can redeem. Okay, I'll take the land. Then watch this. "Then Boaz said, 'On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance.'" You got the land, and you got a woman that goes with it. And the close relative said, "Well, I can't redeem it. I'm out. I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance." There's a lot there that I don't understand. But let's just deal with it now. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a confirmation in Israel. So that's going to happen here. There's no spitting in the face that takes place here. I don't know if the custom got watered down or if there were some other circumstances involved. I'm not sure of all that. "Therefore the close relative said to Boaz, 'Buy it for yourself.' So he took off his sandal. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, 'You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi.'" That was their contract. That was their deed at the courthouse, that all the witnesses saw it. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from his brethren and from the position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. And all the people who were at the gate and the elder said, we are witnesses. Lord, make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah. Remember those two that sort of had the dueling pregnancies and kept building up the household of Jacob with 12 sons. Lord, make your house like the house of Rachel and Leah. May you have a bunch of kids. The two who built the house of Israel, may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. There are those two words again. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. Now there's a sordid story. You know that story, don't you, in Genesis 38? Let me sum it up for you quickly because I'm running out of time. Judah had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. Married a wife, didn't have any children. Lord killed because he was wicked. Onan went in to perform that duty. The Mosaic law wasn't in effect yet, but apparently it was custom at that time. He went in to raise up offspring to her, but he worked it so he didn't have to raise offspring to her, and the Lord got mad at him, killed him too. And Judah said, just wait on Shelah till he grows up a little bit. And then when Shelah grew up a little bit, Judah seems to be holding back on the promise to give him to Tamar because, well, maybe he doesn't want that son killed too. He seems to be trouble, you know, in his mind. So Tamar does a wicked thing. She puts on the attire of harlot, goes to the city, and Judah does a wicked thing. He goes to the city, and at night he's looking for a harlot. He goes into Tamar, and she eventually has Perez and Zerah, and Perez becomes the next in the lineage of Christ. Sordid story. Lineage of Christ. But I think that's why he's complimenting Perez here. May your house become like Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman. I don't know that he knows all that he's saying, but there's a lot in what he's saying. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be, catch this, may he be to you a restorer of life and nourisher of your old age. Dad was sick. He had his first bypass in 75, his second in 85. By 88, they told him all those bypasses had collapsed, and at that time they couldn't do anything else for him. You could just drop over at any time. So we were all nervous. About 1990, my sister adopted a six-year-old little girl. And Dad perked up like he hadn't perked up in a while. His first grandchild. Well, there was a stepson, but his first grandchild. And he perked up, and one of his friends told me, I think your dad lasted two more years. She was a restorer of life and nourisher of your old age. And we dropped off our kids at Harding. I came back the next Sunday. We had moved from one congregation to another. We had moved our house that month. And we dropped off both our kids and come back to a new house, an empty nest. And that Sunday in church, I sat there and wept. I couldn't sing. One of the elders checked on me to see how I was doing the next day. And I said, I'm sorry I couldn't sing because this empty nest is killing me. And he said, just look forward to the day that they come home with grandchildren. Just look forward to that day. So I don't know if they will or not, and I don't know how that'll work out. But this is restorer of life and nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons. She treats you better than seven boys would treat you. That's not hard for you ladies to figure out, is it? Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. She's the nurse for this little baby. After she was bitter, after things happened to her that she didn't want, after a famine, 10 years in a foreign land, death of a husband, death of two sons, coming back wondering what's going to happen, she's holding this precious little grandchild in her old age. Also, the neighbor women gave him a saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David, the king. Now, this is the genealogy of Perez from Judah and Tamar. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon. Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David. What's the importance of listing those names there? You could read that same list in Matthew chapter 1, and it keeps going until you get Joseph, the husband of Mary, who was supposed to be the father of Christ. This poor, bitter woman spent 10 years in a foreign land. I like to think of the day that she finally gets to hold that baby, rock that baby, nurse that baby, that she, after so much, but do you know how many days she had to go through to get there? How many days she had to get up and say, why has God done this to me? Oh, another day. I don't really want to get up today. I'd rather stay in bed. I don't know if there's any good come from this. I got Ruth. I don't know how I'm going to take care of her. I guess we'll go back home. I don't know what to do. How many days she just trudged and trudged and trudged along? Until finally, an explosion of fireworks lights up her heart. I suppose, in some ways, that's what we have to wait for when we trudge along. And that explosion that lights up our heart like fireworks, I'll be honest with you, might not come till the resurrection day. But it'll come. She's holding someone in the lineage of the Christ. The lineage of the Christ is there to prove that he's the Son of God. The Son of God is proven by his resurrection. We will benefit from his resurrection. When we trudge through life, we have to remember that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that will be revealed in us. Romans 8, verse 18. Would you pray with me, please? Father in heaven, we thank you for such a wonderful story. Tragedy that turned into such blessing. Help us to remember it when things don't go the way we want them to. And help us to press ahead. Put one foot in front of the other. Take the next breath, even when we don't feel like it. Trusting, hoping, waiting, that we might soar like eagles. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen. Well, I thank you for having me this week. I've really, really enjoyed the time. Thank you.